Welcome to City Club of Eugene, January 17th program, Lock Them Up, the Costs of Incarceration. This is the 17th program of our 2019-2020 program year. I'm Joel Curran, and I am the past president and program chair of City Club. Support for City Club is provided by our members and our sponsors. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, and our diamond sponsors are Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high-quality, affordable health care services to improve the health of their members and the communities they serve. More information at www.kp.org. The University of Oregon. Support comes from the University of Oregon. Since 1876, the UO has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. Peace Health. Peace Health is proud to serve Eugene, Lane County, and beyond as your hometown healthcare provider for more than 80 years. Our mission is to keep you and your family healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org and Lane County College. Lane County College transforms lives through learning and provides comprehensive, accessible, high-quality educational opportunities that promote student success. For more information, visit lanecc.edu programs. And we'd also acknowledge the generous support of the City of Eugene. Our program today is Lock Them Up, the Costs of Incarceration, and I'd like to introduce Josh Purvis from the program committee, who is coordinator for this event.
The United States of America incarcerates more of its citizens than any other country in the world, and at a higher rate. More than Russia, more than China, more than North Korea. In Oregon, at any given time, nearly 24,000 men, women, and children are incarcerated in Oregon's federal and state prisons, county jails, and youth correctional facilities. Nearly half of those incarcerated in prisons have been diagnosed with a mental illness or developmental disability. The Oregon Health Authority reports that every year in Oregon, an estimated 26,000 people are released from jails and 5,500 are released from state and federal prison. While the moral and legal justifications for this alarming trend are multifarious, what we can objectively consider are the cost of such a system. Those costs are the primary focus of today's program. To help us assess it, we have three individuals well qualified to examine the human, social, and economic cost of incarceration. Presenting first is Captain Clint Riley, Lane County Jail Commander. Captain Riley began his career with the Lane County Sheriff's Office as a deputy in the Corrections Division. Since then, he's been assigned to the Main Jail, Forest Work Camp, Public Information Office, and the Community Service Office, and has held rank as Deputy Sheriff, Sergeant, and Lieutenant. Following Captain Riley's presentation, Laura Johnson and Andy Coe will each provide summary remarks. Laura Johnson is Director of Program Development of Sponsors, a Eugene-based reentry organization that serves people with conviction histories. She previously served as the Deputy Program Manager with the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, and as Assistant Director of the University of Oregon School of Law's Appropriate Dispute Resolution Center. Mr. Coe is the Executive Director of the Partnership for Safety and Justice, Oregon's leading public safety and criminal justice reform organization. He previously held positions with the American Civil Liberties Union, was the founding director of the Drug Policy Reform Project in Seattle, and represented homeless and low-income people in New York City. He is a graduate of the New York University School of Law. So on behalf of City Club and the City of Eugene, I welcome these distinguished guests to speak today on the topic of the cost of incarceration. I'll now turn it over to Captain Riley to give his presentation. Captain.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me here today. As Josh said, I am the Lane County Jail Commander. I work for the Lane County Sheriff's Office. So I think it'd be important. I want to just kind of do a quick overview of the state of Oregon and how sheriff's office work. So we have 36 counties in Oregon. Every county has an elected official that is their sheriff. The sheriff is mandated to run jail operations in their county. So we have about 33 county jails in Oregon. Some smaller counties have come together and they have one jail, but that is one of the main things that your elected official as a sheriff oversees: corrections operations. So as we have our arm of law enforcement working in the corrections division and the sheriff, we have police officers out on the street. Those folks out there, they arrest people and bring them to jail. We are, as part of our marching orders, we're mandated to hold those folks in jail and get them through the court system. And so as they're in jail, the court systems are the ones that decide whether they stay in jail or whether they're released. And so while we have them in jail, the sheriff, myself, none of us make the decisions on who stays and who goes. It's the court systems. But we are tasked with, and me specifically, once they're in my facility, making sure we run a facility that is humane, gives them the things they need as they maneuver the court system. So with that, I think a good background like that, just so you kind of know what our role is here locally. And so when somebody goes to prison, that's a state function, and then they're typically there for a prison sentence of a year or longer. So what I see in the county jail is we have pre-trial detainees. That's somebody that's innocent until proven guilty, and then when they're found guilty, they would be sentenced. And we can house folks up to a year or less in the county jail. If they get a year or more, they go to prison. So our role here locally is dealing with pre-trial detainees for the most part through all the court systems we have here in Lane County. We have Eugene Municipal Court, Springfield Municipal Court, State Circuit Court. There are lots of little courts throughout Lane County. So with that said, we probably book in about 11,500 folks a year. We are one of few jails in Oregon. I can tell you we have the most robust pretrial services system in our facility. We have the state courts in our jail. So when somebody books in our jail, the first thing we're looking at is how do we get them back out of our jail? And they do over 6,000 what they call release agreements a year. Those release agreements are somebody can maneuver the court process, whether they're being held in jail or they go back home. They could go back home, get court dates, and show up and appear and go through the court system, whether they're in jail or out of jail. And as I said earlier, I don't make those decisions, the courts make those decisions. So as prosecutors and defense attorneys and judges oversee cases, they decide who stays in the jail and who gets released. And then I am mandated to hold those folks and make sure they don't leave if the courts want them there. And then when they say they're released, then I am mandated to release them. And so there's never been a time, and there never will be, that the sheriff ever called me and said, the person the judge said released from jail, hold that person. It doesn't work like that. We get a lot of credit for who we release and who we hold, though. And so that was the reason for my overview of how that system works. One thing you will hear, most jails have to release due to overcrowding. So when we are overcrowded, we have a federal consent decree. We can't hold more than 93% of our population at any time in our jail. So a lot of times the courts are telling us to hold somebody, but that court consent decree, we have to release them. And so those are when the sheriff makes decisions to release folks that the courts are telling us to hold. We get those confused a lot with people that are on release agreement, post-security, post-bail, or they're forced released. When somebody goes to jail, they have a lot of constitutional rights, and one of them is to post-security and post-bail. So you can be in jail for what someone might consider to be a heinous crime. If you post a bail or security, that is your constitutional right, and you can release them. There's nothing that we can do as the sheriff's office to stop that. I'm asked about that quite often, why we release somebody that was in jail for what one would consider to be a heinous crime, because they're innocent until proven guilty, and they have a constitutional right to post that security or that bail. So with that said, just a quick little overview. Now I'm going to get more into like what I do and what I take a lot of pride in. So the Sheriff's Office, we have an elected official. Cliff Harold is our Lane County Sheriff. We have three main divisions in the Sheriff's Office. We have the Office of Sheriff, which is administration, which is a sheriff and undersheriff, and kind of like our payroll functions and budget stuff, that is the administration section. The two big divisions, and I have the biggest one, is the Corrections Division and the Police Division. So I am the captain of the Corrections Division. We have roughly 165 employee positions within the Corrections Division, and I have 139 sworn personnel that work for me. And so those would be deputy sheriffs that are corrections certified to work in corrections. They wear a deputy sheriff uniform, and they look just like the deputies that you see out on patrol. They just work in the corrections end of things. Our Lane County Jail, your Lane County Jail, has 507 jail beds. Of those 507 right now, we have funding for 411. We have 96 jail beds that are closed that we don't have funding to run. And then our federal consent decree, I can't go over 382 individuals that are in jail in any given day. We got to be at 382. We rent 15 beds to the city of Eugene for their Eugene Municipal Court. So local beds available for local offenders in Lane County is 367. So now if you bounce back to a second ago when I said we have 11,500 bookends to our jail a year, and we probably do 6,000 release agreements, and we probably force release a few thousand more a year, we don't have a lot of jail beds in our community. As we were talking earlier, there's jails around the state that are building bigger jails and adding jail beds, and it's really important to understand how many jail beds you have in your community and how they're being used, and what are some of the other options to use those things. I'm a firm believer in our pretrial system. If somebody has a job, if they got a home, if they got a family, and they got things going out in the community, and they can maneuver the court system, I support them doing that back home. When we release them from jail, the hardest thing to do is to find housing, get them propped back up in the community, and get them working. So we have systems within the Sheriff's Office that support getting them out of jail. I only hold people when the courts want them held, and they don't want them to be released from jail. We house 382 of a lot of violent offenders, folks with mental illness, folks that come into our facility. We have 382 very challenging folks at any given time in our facility. We're one of the few jails that have lots of alternative programs. If you get sentenced to do time in the Lane County Jail, we will try to not have you do it in the jail itself, in a hard bed in the jail. We have a residential reentry center. We have an electronic surveillance program, ankle bracelet program. We have a defendant offender management center where we offer GEDs, education. We run a work crew program out of there. Anything we can do to better yourself while you're in jail without having to be in jail doing your jail sentence. And so someone comes into the Sherman Center, it literally looks like this. They'll hand us a piece of paper, says they got 10 days to do in the jail. The courts have deferred that to us to handle that. We'll ask them, do you have a job? Where do you live? What's it going to take for you to be successful? We might give them a month to do those 10 days working around their schedule. They come from home to do road crew. The folks you see out and about in the community working on the highway, they all go home at night. We don't use our money to house them in the jail so that we have them for 10 straight days. We send them back home and we work around the things that are going successful for them in their life right now. Support services piece to run a jail. The jail is like a world within a world. We've got building maintenance, laundry services, inmate programs, facility security. We have folks that run all the cameras that are in there. Talk about a little bit of our revenue. We are very fortunate to have passed a law enforcement levy in 2014. And the jail levy that we have pays for essentially half of our funding in the corrections division. We have a $33 million budget. $17 million of that budget comes from that levy that the taxpayers generously passed here in Lane County and then renewed again last year. All the other funds, we have funding that comes from Justice Reinvestment, our Eugene Municipal Contract, Community Corrections Act, Measure 73, Measure 57, lots of different grants and stuff coming in, and General Fund. General Fund is your county taxpayer dollars as well. equals about $16 million of our operation. So that jail levy pays for a little bit more than that for us to have the program that I just talked about having. Some other expensive things that we see in there, we have a little over $4 million medical contract. We have 30 medical full-time employees that work in our jail. I have two 24/7 medical nurses around the clock that work in the jail. One works in our booking area. Everyone that comes in our jail is screened by a nurse and cleared to be in jail. We see so many medically and mentally ill inmates coming to jail that we had to put that process in place to make sure that we could safely house the folks that are coming to our facility. I have six full-time mental health professionals that work in our jail. I have a half-time psychiatrist and a full-time psychologist. We have turned into the biggest mental health facility in Lane County is the county jail. I probably know lots of you as I look out in the audience. I go to lots of groups every day, and we're trying to get momentum going to build a crisis center and do different things and keep folks out of the jail. As I started my presentation out with, I don't go out and pick who comes to jail, and I don't have a say in who stays in jail. But I am mandated to make sure the people I have in our facility, I take good care of them, and I do the best I can with what I've got. So with that, I'll close with that one.
Hello, City Club. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. As we speak, there are approximately 15,000 people held in our state prisons. 95% of them will be returning home. So if we are investing, as we've heard, hundreds of millions of dollars to keep them there, we could reasonably expect that they'd be in a better place when they come back to our communities. That unfortunately is not the case for most of them. About 6,000 people were released from Oregon State prisons last year. The Department of Corrections reports that more than 50% of them released to homelessness. 90% were indigent with no employment prospects. 58% of the people who are currently held in Oregon State prisons have a diagnosed mental health need, and more than 67% have a history of substance abuse disorder or addiction. The correlation between past trauma and criminal justice system involvement is a known and proven one. People who commit crimes have experienced tremendous pain. So knowing this, our response to crime, our system response, could be to ask, what happened to bring you to this place, to such a point of desperation? Let us help you heal. That could be our response, and that's how we could invest those millions of dollars. In most cases, though, that's not what we do. We lock people away in a place where they can neither be seen nor heard. We remove them from their families, from their employment, from their support systems. We replace their given names with an 8-digit number, and we repeatedly define them by the single most shameful thing they've ever done. So I want to ask you to take a minute to consider the single worst thing you've ever done. Maybe it wasn't illegal, but something they're ashamed about. Maybe it caused harm to someone else. It wasn't your best self. And now imagine if that thing was publicly known, that anybody could look it up at any point, and that thing was used to consider whether you might qualify for an apartment, rent a job, get a job, when you apply for auto insurance, financial aid, a volunteer position. That thing could be known to anyone, and it would follow you everywhere you went. And people used that thing as a basis to determine your human value. Now, would that be accurate or fair? You know, of course it wouldn't, right? Because you are not that thing. Yet that is the reality that people experience when they go to prison, and the reality that continues to follow them when they return to our communities, when they completed their sentences. We continue to identify them by those things, by their past, even as we ask them to reform. There are more than 48,000 laws and regulations that restrict employment opportunities and benefits for people with incarceration histories. The unemployment rate for people with conviction histories is higher than the rate of unemployment during the Great Depression. The rate of homelessness for people with incarceration histories is 10 times that the rest of us experience, though we know that housing is the single most important factor in a person's successful reentry. We also have to consider, if we're going to talk about costs, the human costs of for the people who do time alongside their loved ones. Across this country, one in 12 children has experienced parental incarceration. Here in Oregon, 80% of the women we've sent to state prison were the sole provider for a child under the age of 18 at the time that they were convicted. Given current statistics, that's 927 mothers whose children were more than likely swept into the foster care system. It currently costs $30,000 a year to hold a child in foster care. So if each one of those mothers had just one child that entered the system, that's an annual cost approaching $28 million just for that foster care placement alone. And that doesn't begin to consider the human costs, the isolation, the fear, the abandonment, the guilt, all of the things that continue that cycle of trauma. But there are some reasons for hope. I'll just highlight a couple programs here in Oregon that are doing promising things to reduce those costs, both human and financial. The Family Sentencing Alternative Program allows parents and pregnant women who are to remain here in their communities to receive intensive supervision and treatment in lieu of going to prison. So far, participants in that pilot program, 80% of them have been successful and have avoided prison time. And among them, their children have on average spent 500 fewer days in foster care per child as compared to children whose parents went to prison. And in Lane County, at Sponsors where I work, we provide housing and wraparound services to more than 600 individuals releasing from incarceration every year. And despite the fact that we serve people who are homeless and at greatest risk to return to the system, participants in our long-term housing program are 60% less likely to go back to prison within the 3 years. So we have a long way to go, clearly, but there are possibilities and a lot of hope to reduce these human costs, the financial costs, and have better outcomes if we're willing to invest in rehabilitation over punishment. Thank you. I'll turn it over to Andy Coe.
And I'm Andy Coe from Partnership for Safety and Justice. So when we think about the cost of incarceration, we start with from a standpoint of recognizing that incarceration is, in our system, the default response to crime. And I should say right off the bat, the captain and I did talk a bit about some of the programs. There's a lot of work, great work being done, but what we're really talking about ourselves is the system. We look at the whole system and see what is happening, what are needs being met, and what are the costs of the system. When we think about it, we look at the totality of the system. And I obviously can't talk in 5 minutes about the totality of the system, or probably even in a whole day. But there are certain ones that come up over and over again, and Lauren mentioned some of them already. It's the impact on families. What happens with children? It's the impact on crime victims of the system and the cost of incarceration. That's something that my organization in particular is very concerned about and has done an awful lot of work around. And then there's the impact on communities overall. So let me talk a little bit about some of those. One of the things that, I used to do foster care work when I first came out of law school. One of the things that people don't think about very much when someone's being convicted of a crime and being sentenced to some form of incarceration, whether it's a jail sentence or a prison sentence, is that the majority of women, and actually the majority of men as well in Oregon, are parents of minor children. What happens to those children? They might be, if they're lucky, they might be raised by relatives. If they're not so lucky, they'll be going into the foster care system. What that does to a child, if you think yourselves as parents, if you were to be, something were to happen where you were being incarcerated, what would happen to your children? I don't know what would happen to my daughter if I were incarcerated. Thinking about crime victims, the one thing I'll say sort of make a simplistic statement about crime victims. Crime victims don't all want all the same thing, but they're generally offered the same thing. They're offered incarceration. We will punish the person who hurt you. We'll punish the person who stole your property. If it's a drug crime, maybe we'll talk a little bit about that. Then it becomes a little bit more vague, but we still start thinking about, we need to punish somebody for their breaking the laws against drug possession or drug sales or what have you. Communities. Now, for communities, the impact and the cost of incarceration may seem like it gets a little bit broader, but it's actually quite concrete. About 96% of people who are incarcerated, 96, 97, maybe some places 95, of people who are incarcerated will be coming back out into the community. What does that mean for your community? What do we expect of those people? when they come back into the community? What should they expect of us in terms of their opportunities to carry on with their lives? What does it do to our communities when someone is unemployable because of a conviction? And that could happen in any conviction. It could happen for an arrest if there's a record of it that somebody digs up. What do we expect of that person in terms of not breaking any laws into the future when they can't find housing, they can't find employment? Usually what happens to folks in that situation is they find an underground economy to actually survive in. So thinking about what the human costs are in addition to the dollars and cents costs is really pretty critical. And that's one thing that our organization in particular, we think about. That's sort of our starting point, is what are the impacts? What are the needs? Are they being met? And really, what is the system about? What are we actually trying to achieve with the system? And again, on a micro level, which is equally important, having diversion programs, having programs to get people released pre-trial so they can actually defend themselves effectively, maintain their employment, keep their children in their household, that's all critically important. But we're actually really thinking about why is it that we default to incarceration to begin with. Thank you.
Today, the first question will be asked by State Senator James Manning. I'd introduce the Senator Moore, but everybody knows the Sarge.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Afternoon. City Club, thank you so much for allowing this great panel. I heard everything that you said. Well, as you suggested, question first. The private prison industry, we know that a lot of times are the ones that's behind and support extended stays in jail and stuff. I'd like to know, you had mentioned a little bit about the ankle monitoring devices and stuff. I would like to know a little bit more about what that is like in Lane County, who is being offered that and at what cost. And I say this because in 2017, I voted as a member of Senate Judiciary, we voted against private prisons here in the state of Oregon. We know that locking people up for extended stays for money and stuff is not the best way to keep families together. We also know that using our jails as an alternative to treating people with mental health, mental disorders and stuff is not the way we want to go, but we're there and we need to reverse that trend. I appreciate the work you're doing there. But the cost is what's really important. And I want to know if there are influences from private industries trying to make money off the backs of those that are incarcerated or being held in jail. I'm really interested in that because I will intend to stop that practice. We don't need more jails. We don't need private industries trying to make money off the backs of the unfortunate. And we certainly don't need jails who are not equipped with dealing with our mentally ill people to be the first stop. And once they leave, there are no wraparound services. So with that, I got my 30 seconds out. Beat the buzzard. Thank you.
All right. Great question. I'm going to kind of go back to the structure I laid out before. So Lane County, pretrial, county jail, of how we look at that. The senator was talking about prison. So what we do with our pretrial system or with our ankle monitoring system, lots of those release agreements that I was talking about before. Let's talk about domestic violence. Domestic violence is a big thing that we see in our community, and it involves a victim, a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety goes into those release decisions. We use ankle monitoring to do release agreements for folks to release them from jail, to get them back to all the things we were talking about, but also safeguard the victim as well. And they're monitoring that person on the back end. What we do, the $33 million sticker shock that I threw out to everyone of what it costs to run our corrections operation, it's still not enough. We pass a lot of those fees on to the person that's on the ankle monitor itself. It's a sliding scale, and they will pay for the ankle monitoring service themselves when they're released. Otherwise, if we were to recoup the cost and do that all for free, we would pay for it. It'd be more tax dollars we'd have to collect to be able to pay for that. So I get asked those questions a lot. They're great questions. We try to, at the sheriff's office, we try to do the best we can with what we got, and we do a little bit of funding, grants, using our funding, and then sometimes offset with fees from the individual that's on the program. And so I don't have anyone coming into our facility to get more specific to sell us services and do that kind of stuff. We have an ankle monitoring program and a service, and there's technology there, and then we use our staff to run it. And I think we have probably close to 75 to 80 people on ankle monitor at any given time, whether they're pretrial or you can be sentenced and go back to a remote area in Oregon and do your Lane County jail sentence on an ankle monitor somewhere else as you get back to your job and working. So, yeah. Hopefully I answered that question.
Do any of the other speakers wish to respond to that?
Can I just say something?
I think, you know, on an individual basis, releasing someone with a monitor is almost always going to be better for them. They're going to be able to carry on with their lives, hopefully be employed. I totally agree with that. What I am more concerned about is the ways in which we are using probation and control, even when there's not a jail cell, to control people's lives and to do it on an extended basis, sometimes for years. I mean, some people, for their lifetimes, really. And any one of us, we walk out the front door here, and there's a chance that we'll break a law. You know, and there's also the chance that someone, if we were on probation and someone's looking over a shoulder, that could have a huge impact on our lives. The other thing I'll say, and this goes to the senator's referencing of private prisons, very unpopular now, unpopular in this group as well from the applause, but they are themselves masters of marketing and trying to figure out how to make money, and they're starting to move in, this is our understanding, was they're starting to move into the provision of services. They're there already, but they're looking for the better investment, and as we move more into non-carceral ways of controlling people, it's still sort of carceral when you've got, you know, you get somebody monitoring you, we're going to see more and more of that, and if we're not vigilant, it's going to creep in and it's going to stay. It's going to be very hard to get back out of the system. So it's just something we should be conscious of and careful about.
Anyone else? Oh. Okay, we will now break for 5 minutes to formulate your questions, and we'll see you back on the other side. Thank you.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC, Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Welcome back to the January 17th, 2020 program, Lock Them Up, the Cost of Incarceration. Before we proceed, I'd like to recognize our gold sponsors, Pacific Cascade Federal Credit Union, Jerry Detelm, architect and landscape architect, and our Sapphire sponsor, AARP of Oregon. AARP celebrates creating livable communities for all ages. Learn more at aarp.org/OR. And our in-kind sponsors, KRVM 91.9, PacInfo and Simplified Computing, LLC, Dot Dotson Photography, Network Charter School, and KLCC, who broadcasts our programs now at a new time, Monday evening at 7 o'clock on 89.7 and Community Channel 29 for broadcasting our programs. And we will now go to questions.
Pat Bryan, City Club member since 2019. I have a question for Andy Coe. New York Times Magazine at the beginning of this year had a cover story on the parole hearing reform in California. In Oregon in 2020, where can citizens bring pressure on reducing incarceration, whether through parole hearings reform or otherwise? And how do we combat community concerns reinforced by fear-mongering of entrenched criminal justice officials and politicians about returning prison inmates to the general population?
I think I have an answer to that. This is Andy Coe, Partnership for Safety and Justice. Try to obey the rules here. So where can you plug in? First, I'm going to give you a website. It's our website. I know it's shameless self-promotion, but you'll get some good information there. So that's safetyandjustice.org, easy enough to remember. We also do quite a bit of legislative work and other of our partner organizations, not just us. So tapping into some of other organization that's doing work that is of interest to you and aligns with what your values are would be really helpful. And the one last thing I'll mention very briefly here is that there is there's a proposed ballot initiative that's out for signatures right now to decriminalize drug possession, and by that effectively decriminalize addiction, and to greatly increase services for people who are suffering from addiction, substance use disorders. So getting involved in that and supporting that and having the hard discussions that you have around the dinner table about things like that is a great way to get engaged.
My name is Ty, and I've been a City Club member since 2019. Andy, you closed your presentation by asking why. For everyone in the audience who heard the costs, economic and human, of the existing system and thought those costs are too high, that's the key question. Why do we have this punitive, expensive system instead of, say, an emphasis on alternatives like restorative justice? And how can we change this?
Andy Koh, Partnership for Safety and Justice. Why? I think it's a multifold answer. I think one is that institutions are built, they're built for different reasons, and over time we might forget why they were built. But those institutions continue on, whether or not they actually serve the purpose that we have for them. And so, for example, we have the institution of law enforcement that leads to arrest, prosecution, and quite often incarceration. What I think we often forget is that incarceration is not something that has always just been there. We treat it as if it's the natural way to respond to crime. It was an innovation. One time when somebody stole something or committed some other crime, at best it was corporal punishment because we didn't lock people up or we killed them. It was execution. Almost every major crime was a capital crime. We can actually do better than incarceration. We are doing better than incarceration already, but those programs need to be greatly, greatly expanded, and we need to change our thinking about what the system is about and to question whether it's giving us what we want now and if it's not, asking for something different.
My name is Todd, and I'd like to ask a question of Laura. What changes in the law might be needed to allow judges to commit people to mental hospitals? And I know this is an unpopular idea, but in 1973, I had a drug psychosis and I was arrested and I was sentenced to commitment to the VA for several months. And as a result of that, I got mental health treatment and I didn't get a criminal record. And after a couple more years of recovery, I got LCC and I got to U of O and I got a life. And so I'd like to see that happen for more people. And I think when they dismantled the mental hospitals, I think it had some unfortunate side effects. Thank you.
Thank you.
Laura Johnson, sponsors. I think you speak to some concerns that I share around flexibility in sentencing. Because of things like Measure 11 and mandatory minimum sentences, we've tied judges' hands in many circumstances. We provide them with sentencing guidelines and we say that if this certain crime has been committed, this is the mandatory sentence that you must impose. You may not consider mitigating factors. You may not consider other things that may have led this person to this place. And so I think that if we were to roll back some of those very critical and impactful ballot measures like Measure 11, I think we could make some very meaningful changes.
Skip Coburn, City Club member since 2018. So a question that a couple folks down here had was, are you aware, and this could be to any of the panelists, are you aware of any preventive services in existence that can help keep people out of jail to begin with, and what the cost of services might be?
Sure. I can speak to that. Laura Johnson, sponsors. There are many, and fortunately, because of some recent changes, particularly with the Justice Reinvestment Act, we have things like drug courts.
things like mental health courts that allow people to remain in the community and receive treatment services and intensive supervision to address many pressing issues. I think if we're going to talk about primary prevention, though, we need to talk about families. We need to talk about kids. We need to talk about poverty and racial inequality and the social fabric that has led us to this place where we have created a permanent underclass of people that we throw into prison and then treat as a permanent underclass when they return to our communities. We have to be lifting people up a little bit more so that they're not finding themselves torn into the system.
Clint Riley, jail commander. One thing I'd like to add to that, too, I see people, once they've been through that process and the decision's been made to take them to jail, I'm going to throw a high number out, but I'd say it's probably close to 90% of the folks that I see that are in jail, drug addiction, alcohol addiction, or mental health play a vital role to their criminality. So if you replace those three things, the criminal element probably isn't there. I've met a lot of folks in my 29 years of doing this line of work that are just like you and I, but they get the addiction overtakes what's going on, and they become a petty thief to make enough money every day to support that addiction, and that addiction is driving everything they're doing, and those folks end up in my facility. But I asked the same question I just asked: what can we do on the front end to keep them from coming to me, to get them back on, to get a life back, like that gentleman said back there?
Jerry Smith, City Club member for 17 years. Do you publish the number of people in your system who are homeless, who have no income or no work history? I ask that question because it's a great mystery to the public. They've done away with welfare as if there was no problem. They've done away with mental health care as if there were no problem.
Clint Riley, jail commander. That's probably a question for all three of us. I see a lot of folks that wind up in jail that are homeless. And I'll go back to what I just said a minute ago. I think the drug addiction, alcoholism, and mental health play a big role in that piece there. But yeah, we do track the data, and I don't have right in front of me, but it's a large percentage of folks.
Is it published on a website somewhere?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't think we have that on there. But we use it internally as we work as a community to try to figure out different avenues and different off-ramps and different groups. And there's lots of work going on. I see Paul Solomon now. He's on groups with me. Well, there's lots of groups going on right now in our community where you're bringing law enforcement with all the nonprofits and all the organizations to support this cause. We're all working on it to include the courts. And we're very supportive of trying to find different off-ramps to get folks on, to get them out of the criminal justice. The most expensive way to handle this issue is to put somebody in jail and have the criminal justice system go through that. If you're a drug addict and you do 120 days in my jail, when you get out, you're probably still a drug addict if we haven't done something to help you with the addiction. Just 120 days in jail doesn't all of a sudden make them not a drug addict anymore. And so
I'll say two things. One is that yesterday, so Partnership for Safety and Justice, Andy Coe, Partnership for Safety and Justice also has a political arm, a separate entity. And we did some interviews with DA candidates last night. And one of the candidates said that he was...
Candidates for what?
District Attorney. I said DA. I said alphabet soup. District Attorney.
In
County
Multnomah
County District Attorney. And had committed to more transparency, to actually publish the numbers, exactly the numbers that you just mentioned. It was like almost exactly the same list. And they are critically important to know. I would say also another thing in terms of dealing with that dynamic of people who are mentally ill, have substance use disorders, or have some other poverty, some other reason that has sort of funneled them into the system, is to start working towards making sure that those things are not criminalized. Right now, addiction is one easy one, and we just have to wrap our heads around that idea. Poverty is a big problem in economic disparities. We need to wrap our heads around that one. Homelessness, mental illness, we need to make sure that there's enough health care for people. I mean, these are all really heavy lifts, but we're not going to solve this problem without actually addressing those problems.
My name is Sharon Reed. I've been a city member, a city club member since 2018. My question for the commander and perhaps for Lori, what is the percentage of male and females being incarcerated or non-binary incarcerated in the jail? Are the facilities different? And are there other programs then that are more geared towards those genders? Thank you.
Laura Johnson, sponsors. I would be speaking likely more to the prison figures than to jail. Here in Oregon, the female prison population has increased significantly in recent years, and yet it's about 10%, 10 to 12% of the general prison population in the state system. There have been improvements in terms of gender-responsive programming, if you will. There's been, in the past 5 to 10 years, a greater awakening to the different path that leads women into incarceration and the different needs that women have as they return to the communities. There's a lot more we can do there, and I think you also referenced the fact that our system is very binary. We have perpetuated this social idea of gender binariness, this you're either male or female, and the system is beginning to be more innovative and more inclusive in considering people who don't identify along a binary line as well, but there are challenges there for sure, and there's lots of room to do better.
Clint Riley, Lane County Jail Commander. One thing I would say, our jail probably is 80% male, probably 20% female. We have seen an increase in female incarceration over the years. I don't have data in front of me, but one thing I can tell you just from experience, most folks, and I'd throw males into that as well, is we don't always deal a lot with trauma. Trauma is a big piece that continues someone's criminality. And just throughout the years of hearing the stories of women that are in jail and in prison, they were a lot of them were victims of crimes as kids that led to substance abuse, that led to their criminality. And we need to go back and start dealing with the trauma to help them heal, to work through that. But working in a jail, working in a prison, doing some of the things I've done, I've got a whole other side of the human beings that we see incarcerated and some of the horrific things that happened to them that led to their criminality, that led to substance abuse, that led to the life they're living. So that's one piece I've seen that's real and it's true. And a lot of the women that are incarcerated have addiction issues coming from undealt with trauma throughout their life.
Karen Seidel, City Club member. This is a small subset question of the previous question. If 20% of the population in the Lane County Jail are women, what's the proportion of deputies who work in the jail who are women?
Clint Riley in Lane County Jail. Great question. Thank you for bringing that up. If we could recruit for more female deputies, I will hire as many as I could get. We have a need for female deputies in the jail. Not only do we do specific job tasks that are gender related, we just don't have a huge number of women that want to work in this profession and come forward, so I'm recruiting all the time. But we do have, we have minimum staffing standards. We have women that are in there. Going back to trauma, which I was saying before, that's a big part of having women in deputy positions, supervising women that are incarcerated. Men sometimes bring on trauma that's unknown, even though you got nice deputies and they're doing a good job and they're doing all that. Having women role models and supports and help is a big part. So we're always recruiting for women and we need more. So thank you for letting me talk about that.
My name is Bernie Bopp. I've been a City Club member for the past year. Our table question is, what are the impacts on communities of color because of incarceration? What services are lacking for people of color? Addressed to the panel in general.
Laura Johnson, sponsors. I could talk about this for a week or more. The timer went off, that's funny. The disproportionate incarceration and excessive punishment of people in color is
a long-standing problem in this country that goes back to our roots. We talked a little bit earlier, Andy Coe spoke to the reasons that we have developed a prison system, and one of the reasons that we have a system that is structured the way that we do is because we abolished slavery. We started convict leasing when we abolished slavery so that we could continue to have a mass workforce that could be employed in this way. And while there are many improvements in some ways in some of the prison systems, there are places where, for in the state of Alabama, for example, 1 in 3 black males has permanently lost the right to vote because that individual has a felony conviction. There are very serious consequences and around race in this country as it pertains to conviction. I talked about unemployment rates for people who the incarcerated, formerly incarcerated population. For African American women, the rate of unemployment for individuals with incarceration histories is 43%. And this is not because these women don't want to work. There are statistics that say 93% of them are actively out there in the workforce looking for work. But they are really facing, on top of what we already have, lots of racism in our system. We have a system that then over-incarcerates people of color, and then they continue to experience even more severe consequences after they've returned from the system.
So I looked at this a while ago, so I don't know, Andy Coe from Partnership for Safety and Justice. The percentage of the adult male prison population in Oregon was about 9% African American when I looked, and this was a number of years ago. I don't know if it's changed very much since then. For women, it was 7%. So this is in a state that has, I believe it's a little less, but it's about 2% of its population, a general population is African American. That's men, women, and children. That's not even just the adults. So that's a disparity that's somewhat shocking. And when you take a look at some of the ways in which we criminalize people and the ways in which selectivity and inherent biases and latent biases are effective, take the war on drugs, for instance. We essentially have a dual system along class lines, race lines. One is criminalizing, the other one is a medical system where people get treatment and the opportunity to get treatment. Again, I come back to the idea that for things that should not be criminalized, that are not criminal, they're a health issue, we should be removing them entirely from the criminal justice system. And again, that's what IP 44 this year, coming into the November election, is attempting to do.
Thank you very much, all three of you. Great presentations, much appreciated. And I really appreciate the work you do. My name is Douglas Bovia. I've been a member since 2018. Question from our group. I'm gonna, with respect to my table, we had a bunch of questions, and I'm gonna make an executive decision based on previous questions to alter the first choice. I'm gonna take number 2 instead of number 1. Is there a way that a jail inmate can access Oregon Health Plan approved medicines and medical care while they're in jail? And this is probably meant for both Clint and Senator Manning as much as anybody here, but we need to have continuous medical care that will help with the follow-up care afterwards, and losing the Oregon Health Plan while they're in jail is a problem, a big problem.
Clint Riley, Lane County Jail Commander. A great topic to bring up. We've come a long way in the last couple years with that topic right there. So when I was breaking down all those numbers earlier, and we talk about we got a $4.1 million medical contract in our jail, that's your money we're using to pay for medical services in jail. Most of the folks that come to jail are on the Oregon Health Plan. We take them off the Oregon Health Plan to put them on the Lane County Jail health program that you pay for. So I am a strong advocate to keep somebody on that program, because that would use public safety dollars and public safety arenas to still keep people on that. I can't change that. We can talk to the senator about that as we work through that. But what we have done, we have figured out a way to turn somebody's Oregon Health Plan back on when they were released from jail. We, as a society, what I learned when I, about 4 years ago when I first started researching this, when somebody goes to the county jail, our average stay is 24 to 72 hours. Most people get on a release agreement and they get released. We treat them as if they just went to prison for life. We shut off their health services, which they worked really hard to get on, and then they get released. And there for a while, I was chasing this topic around. We had people that were on psychotropic meds, medication they needed in the community. We figured out a way to release them with a prescription, but they didn't have health insurance. So if I could get them to Walgreens, they couldn't pay for it. So we now release them with a supply of medication to get them to that prescription, and we figured out a way to get the Oregon Health Plan turned back on. From a law enforcement agency, we figured out a way to do that, working with the HNHS and the state. And if I have to, I'll have one of my deputy sheriffs drive them to a Walgreens to get that prescription and hand them off in the community if we need to. So yes, that's a topic. And I think, I know that there is groups out there that are looking to try to figure out a way to keep people on them.
Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Okay, sorry. I can go on about that one for a long time.
Next week, City Club has planned your week. Super Week starts on Wednesday at Tsunami Books at 6 with Congressman Peter DeFazio being interviewed by Eric Richardson, our president. Friday at this time is a music program with Francesco Leche Chang, Sabrina Madison Cannon, the new dean of the music school, and Diane Ritalik of the Eugene Concert Choir. Next Friday, 3:00, Harris Hall, Governor Brown will be addressing a special meeting of City Club to talk about her legislative priorities. And with that, I ask you to give our speakers a great round of applause for a wonderful program.